This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning and welcome to The Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutin with Miku Su Chuang. Good morning. We have a great lineup for you this morning.
Exciting. Toe curling.
Toe curling. We've got to think of other ways of describing the work we do.
Titillating?
Titillating. No, I don't think so. I think, you know, if you grew up with a mother like I did, who was an English teacher, you know that the nuances suggest that perhaps titillating is not, even toe curling is kind of wrong. But, you know, we let that slip just because it's 6
Because
we can.
Because
it's 6-1. Yeah, we can. Big day for South Koreans. They go to the polls to elect a new president after that stunning exercise in democracy. South Koreans, have been my heroes for the longest time, because they always seem, since I was a young man, been able to kind of rally them, their troops to, and I mean people, I don't mean the military, to, you know, to bring down dictators and people who've just not lived up to the job. And so, you know, they brought down their president, who was caught up in this terrible, you know, influence and peddling corruption scandal. And they removed it successfully. And now they have another choice to make.
Yeah, it's quite amazing, actually. And I presume you mean in the wake of the French elections, where democracy ruled the roost again over populism. But yeah, you're right, South Koreans have got a lot of things on their plate, including how they deal with the North, the inside.
Absolutely. So North Korea is a big part of the story for the, I think, for the electorate, because it's not simply a question of domestic politics. It's also a question, how do they manage what is a very difficult regime up north or beyond their borders that has consistently threatened them.
And there's different factions within the South Korean fold who are either going to talk about embracing and being discussive with the North, or even being plain militaristic. And there's some opposition as well to American influence on South Korean soil.
Absolutely.
An anti-missile defense system, and not allowing the Americans to play too big a hand in the country.
Yeah, because, you know, they will, you know, it's no fun to be part of the theater of war.
Yeah.
Global powers might find this a great game to play.
Yeah.
But if you're going to, you know, suffer the consequences, and I think the numbers have already been put at some 120,000 dead if one of the scenarios, including a missile attack on Seoul, ensues. So not a pretty picture. I think, you know, as you rightly quoted Winston Churchill not so many days ago, better to jaw than to war.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Exactly. Okay.
I never fingered Winston Churchill as a bit of a, you know, cunning linguist, but clearly he is.
Yeah.
Well, he was, rather.
Yeah, he was, you know. And so are you, Mr. Chuang. We have a grill later on with Leon Fong, general manager of Uber Malaysia. And this is, of course, one of those stories of success, perhaps not as big a success as Grab has been in the ride-sharing app segment of the market, but it's certainly part of the disruptor.
It's been great for the marketplace, clearly, because you've got two quite dominant players and a few other guys as well. So, yeah, it's been good for them. It's been good for the consumer, clearly.
It's good for the consumer, but, you know, if you are like me, you take a Grab or Uber in the morning and you check out how many cars out there there are. And
Grab,
options,
I think, got more, is it?
Grab got more.
Yeah.
It's just a simple
just
fact. I don't know, maybe it's anecdotal, but the point is, there you have it. Also, today, after the 9:30 news, we have the BBC World Service, and it looks at Brexit and all those issues swirling around that. We'll be back with more. BFM 89.9. That was Seed 2.0 by The Roots, a band I'd never heard of until this morning, but I really
but
like it.
But they're on Jimmy Fallon every night.
And I don't watch Jimmy Fallon every night.
Quest Love,
Okay, that's Kusu Chuang, and I'm Sharad Kutin. And Kusu Chuang getting into the I'm a DJ mode.
Nola. Timothy Kang is in the house, yo.
Okay, it's, yo. So now we're faking kind of a part of the youth, what's kind of like youth culture.
That's right.
And, you know, I constantly come up, I see these articles about young people, or rather all people lamenting the fact that as they've grown older, they've been edged out of representation and visibility.
Thus it has always been, and thus it shall always be.
No, I don't know that's true.
Well,
you
it's
know.
Always been.
No, I don't think that's true.
No?
I think, in fact, in many cultures, the problem has always been the opposite, that it's been dominated by older people. And, you know, and it's true in politics. If you look at...
Actually, no, you're right, because I used to cover, you know, I used to be a journalist in London. Uh-huh. And when I went for a press conference, you know how in Malaysia is always that, you know, full of young folks in their 20s, you know, wet between the ears and so, and what have you. In a press conference in London, I used to go, it used to be quite intriguing because the entire room was filled with white hair. I mean, you know, people in tweed jackets have been covering the same sector for 30 years. And, I mean, the experience is amazing among the cluster. But, yeah, you're right, actually.
Yeah, especially so in some professions, you know, being old is a sign of, you know, kind of...
Experience.
Yeah. You know, you're attached to an organization with institutional knowledge and so, all these things that are seen as good. Now, if you look at the front page of Utusan today, it talks about the election of François Macron. But it says President Temudo Francis. It's like Francis, which is, you know, the youngest a French president, and he's the youngest French leader since Napoleon.
Yeah,
right. He's 39. He is.
Quite good in a way, isn't it? In the way that you know people endorse youth over perhaps grey hairs and you know all that.
Yeah, but see, if they just endorsed his youth, that would have been in some sense quite meaningless, unless that youth represented his willingness to change things. And I think one of the things that commentators are saying is that a lot of people are going into the Élysée Palace Palace. They've come into that role at the end of their careers, and they're thinking essentially of legacy in a way that might be a kind of conservative thing. Whereas Fillon comes in as a young man. He's got Macron. Macron comes into this looking at the future, and he wants to reform the state. So he might be more willing to take risks because he's not burdened by the legacy.
He's got a legacy to create. As opposed to someone who's just seeing his twilight years.
That's right. And it's sort of, you know, kind of winding down, as it were. So there are these things. But I wonder, you know, Chuang, you and I are pretty old now. You know, I mean, I'm past 50. You're approaching the Rubicon. Yeah. You're about to cross that river.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I is about 100, I think, or me slightly over 100.
Coming there. Because you're not 50 yet, right?
No, I'm only
51.
Not my long shot, mate. Mentally, anyway.
Two years. No, I don't know about that, actually, even mentally. I know there's an old man in your voice. I mean, I know you try to strike a kind of youngish pose, but do you think...
You call me out on a public radio show, right?
Why not? I think it's a good way. I mean, we're older folk, and I think it's important that we recognize that we come with certain strengths.
Yeah.
I think
and some luggage as well. I mean, I'll be the first to admit it.
Yeah, but sometimes that luggage with carrying a wealth of information. So the bags
are
heavy.
I'd like to think my luggage is Louis Vuitton, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but you know, the thing about it...
Sorry.
Kate Spade has been bought by my coach.
You know,
I never heard of it until somebody
Jimmy
asked
Choo's on the block again.
Yeah, again,
yeah.
But Jimmy Choo doesn't own Jimmy Choo anymore, does he?
No longer. I think, yeah.
Okay, so Coach is buying Kate Spade, and you know, if you know anything about anything
like
about handbags, I don't know anything. Marc Jacobs, you know, I pretend I kind of assimilate it from my girlfriends, and so they're talking about going shopping, and I meant girlfriends in a kind of like neutral, platonic way. But the point is, do you think mass culture today is youth oriented? You know,
absolutely. It's all.
How do we fight it? How do we fight the machine, Chuang? We old folks.
Well, you can't, because that's where the marketers are, right? You don't want to be selling to a crowd who are 50 and above, and then they've got another 5 or 10 years left.
Lots of money,
but you
want them to part with their
money,
right?
But the runway is limited. You see, you want to catch them early at, they say, 18, 20 years old, when just about to enter university or just about to exit university.
Okay, that's in shaping
and they've got
consumer
40 years, 40 years of spending in front of them.
Okay, that may be true, but you know, fashions come and go as fashions will. But you know, so if you have somebody with high net value, isn't that better than a massive young people whose consumption habits are only aspirational?
Not necessarily, because the studies have shown that people at the end of their lives, they tend to spend a lot less.
Do they?
They do, yeah. When you reach 45, 50, 55, you're
bucking the trend then. Because I actually have some money to spend.
But that's how you're contrarian that way, you see. But you know, a lot of people, when they get to their 50, 55, 60 years old, they might have a lot of money, but they're looking towards conserving their cash for the long term and for their retirement age. They're not going to blow it all on, you know, whatever anymore.
Well, you know, I think that's so paradoxical, because as you approach the end of your life, you think you really want to spend your money, because you never know when you're going to go, right?
Carpe diem, right? But
yeah,
not a lot of people
seize the moment,
that.
Seize the day,
yeah.
You know, smell the roses while you may, you know. I think that is really the essence of life. And we older folk, we really know this. I know. Coming up after this, more BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Welcome back to The Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, Kusu Chuang. I'm sorry, I was going to get your name wrong.
Chuang to me mates, mate.
Yeah, you know. Is what? Chuang's your mate?
Chuang to me mates. That's including you, mate. You know?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. That was The Doctor by the Doobie Brothers, because one of those
the
bands.
The Doobie Brothers.
The Doobie Brothers. Doesn't that mark our age? In fact, I think that little.
Good music never goes out of fashion, mate.
This is true. Mm. And if you say mate one more time, I'm going to smack you. Now, speaking of being smacked, you know, just recently there was big news. And I think it's kind of big news that we largely ignored, which is that the world, the globe, as it were, breached the 410 parts per million threshold for CO2s. And that is apparently a historic high for the planet.
I want to reference the breakfast grill you had with the environmentalist. Was it Gurmit Singh? Was that his name?
Yes, Gurmit Singh, last week.
And he mentioned one of his, I think early on in the interview, he mentioned, I think 300 parts per million was the kind of like Paris Protocol benchmark. And we've been in excess of that for the, you know, X number of months. And according to the story, I think from what you've gleaned from the WE Forum, from the WEF Forum.
The World Economic Forum.
Correct. Yeah. The Earth has been getting warmer for 627 months in a row, with last year being the hottest year on record for the third or fourth year running.
Okay, so the thing is, it's not just the last couple of hundred years. This threshold that we hit, this 410 parts per million, is the highest level of carbon dioxide we've had for the planet in millions of years, Chuang. Millions of years.
What does that say?
Well, it says we're on a very rocky road to a lot of trouble very, very soon. I mean, in geological terms, not even geological, I think in human terms, we're talking about 50 years. If we don't reverse this trend, we're going to be in big trouble. We already have climate deniers taking office in the U.S., which, of course, because it's such a big player in, you know, in the world economy, is a very troubling thing. It means that we're not going to, you know, despite what the scientific community has been saying, we're not really going to grapple with the other side of it, which is the political will to change our lives. And I talk about it in terms of myself, Chuang. I know I read articles that have things like, titles like 9 Things You Should Absolutely Have to Know About Global Warming. I mean, these things are everywhere. It's not that we lack information. And that's the
issue. We've got too much information, maybe.
It could be, right? We could have...
It's become, you know, we become fatigued by these sensationalist headlines.
But
and we're kind of like, you know how we got in Malaysia, we've got the saying that, you know, that the frog in water that gets warmer and warmer. And then it's at some point in the future, when it just hits a boiling point, the frog is dead already.
Okay, so fatigue is an interesting word, because it suggests that you've been putting a lot of effort in and you're exerting yourself, and then you get tired. But what if you haven't actually done anything? So what is this? It's information fatigue, maybe in the sense that you've actually been consuming information.
Bombarded by headlines, I think that's the main thing.
No,
right?
I think it's more than that, Chuang. I think it's really about our inability to come to terms with what will have to change if we took this information seriously.
And Gurmit said the same thing. He said that Malaysians, in general, people anyway, they don't want to change, because they, you know, people, they can't get rid of their cars, they can't not fly on holidays, they can't consume, or they can't reduce their consumption of foodstuff which are contained in plastic wrappers. We're all in good. This is modern civilization. This is our social mores, in a way, and we can't shed those habits. I mean, that's the way it is.
So it's so okay. Let's just say the present life, which is hurtling us towards disaster, is something that has become a habit, right? And you can think of it on, you know, very personal level. We often are told that our health is suffering because of certain personal habits we have,
and we continue to do it.
And we continue to do it. And why is it? Despite all that information, despite the doctor sitting in front of you, showing you an X-ray, showing you the results of your blood test, telling you that if you don't change in 10 years, you will either be dead or you will be suffering from a lot of pain, and still people don't change. And it really worries me that, you know, we haven't really talked about this 410 parts per million issue. Even on BFM, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure Earth Matters, you know, which you get on Bigger Picture, has looked at the story, but really, have we really come to terms with it?
No, and I think the early part of a discussion in terms of the Earth moving towards this conclusion, it's two things, right? Because the Earth was, I presume, because of natural climate change, has already been happening. We might have catalyzed and accelerated the process because of our carbon emissions. But be that as it may, and people like Sir James Lovelock have mentioned this already, we passed the point of no return. You know, the Paris Agreement signed in two years ago, talking about keeping global temperatures increases well below 2 degrees centigrade. We've blown past that.
Yeah, so you know what I mean? I think there are naysayers who say that, you know, people from the scientific community believe we're past the tipping point. But question is, you know, does it mean we just sit pretty and let the world go up in flames? Big question for all of us to ask. And Lenny Kravitz has an answer. Are you going my way? BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutan, with me, Kusu Chuang. And that was Give Me All Your Lovin' by ZZ Top. For those of you who love, you know, lots of guitar in the music, because, you know, guitar music really kind of
it wakes you up at 6:39
in the morning.
It
pulls at certain heartstrings, doesn't it? Does it feel
no,
like,
it doesn't have the effect. It revs you up, just like, right. Yeah.
Okay. Because pulling at your heartstrings would suggest something sentimental and mawkish, right?
Mm.
As an expression. Okay.
Richard Clayderman-esque.
Oh, my God, yeah. Not Richard Clay. Oh, Muzak for the world.
Muzak, yeah.
I mean, he was important. I mean, Elevator Rides.
He wasn't important. Please, come on.
Elevator Rides would never have been the same without him. Okay?
Aeroplanes would never be the same without Richard Clayderman.
Okay. Tomorrow's Vesak. Tomorrow's a public holiday.
It is.
Tomorrow, there is no live programming on BFM.
That's just music.
It's just music, music, music. And we asked, in relation to this, Chuang, we put out a poll yesterday, and we asked everyone, you know, do you think we have too many public holidays in Malaysia? And we had a robust discussion about, you know, annual leave versus public holidays. And, you know, over 100 and almost 200 people voted in this poll. 36% said yes, we had too many holidays, and 64% said no.
What's the betting that that 36% are employers and business owners? And what's the betting that the remainder, which is what, 63% were employees? The answer to that question is, it depends.
It really is.
Who you are.
Well, I don't think
if you
it's
run
simply
a business and you own a business, then clearly too many holidays. If
well, because you have to pay overtime for your...
Yeah. You know, people on legislated days off, basically, right? And you've got no control of that because that's what the government has mandated. But if you're an employee or a staff and you get paid a wage, that you don't have enough public
holidays. But,
Chuang,
actually, the discussion was framed this way. We don't actually have enough annual leave. And what would be better for me, and I voted yes, we have too many public holidays, because I wanted to make the point that what we should have is more annual leave and the ability to shape our days off rather than have these obligatory days off where, you know, I have no control. I would rather have taken a Thursday and Friday off rather than a Wednesday off.
I think the poll misses the point. The point here is productivity, okay? And I've seen this happen many, many times over the course of my storied or not storied career.
Self-praise
is no praise, right? look, I mean, you know, for example, if you give a programmer, say, 10 days to finish a particular line of code or piece of code, as opposed to someone else, you know, in some other place, and you give that guy 5 days to finish the same line of code, right? It's all about productivity. If you're given more time to do it, you'll just take the entire allocation.
Yeah, that's
true. You know what I mean? So it's about productivity. It's about, you know, because I used to work with
working
other...
Working smart and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. I used to work in international office, right? And for example, Australians. I'm not blowing the trumpet here, but they would be extremely productive between 9 and 5. But come 4:59 in the afternoon, they'd log off, finish, close shop, but they would have done all their work for the day. Compare that to, say, a Malaysian scenario, whereas you're not necessarily as efficient over the course of the day, and they are still seen at the water fountain, you know, in the office at 6:30, just so that they're the last car in the car park for the boss to see. But they ain't productive.
Okay, that's one possible scenario. Like, let's look at some countries like France. And France now, you know, having had that presidential poll recently, and the winner promising to either make redundant or get rid of the 35-hour workday. Now, one of the things that is being said, and it's of course said by pro-business types, saying that France has pushed itself into a position where it's become very unproductive, and it's destroyed its own work culture.
I would have to agree with that, because
you would agree with that.
I would agree with that because the people, and you know, obviously, when labor laws and politicians and governments bend over backwards to accommodate, you know, the unions, for example, there is an inflection point where it becomes counterproductive to the economy, right? And I've seen lots of mates of mine who have gone to France to have worked. Who I have some mates who are French, and the labor laws there are so conducive to the worker at the expense of the economy.
Okay. So this the long-term effect is it's great for the worker who actually has a job.
So you've got to find
who's got a job, yeah. right? And then you end up destroying the economy, reducing the number of jobs actually available. Yeah. I mean, one of the things, of course, is
a 35-hour a week, work week. It's a very alien concept to Asians because we are used to putting in at least twice as much as that. We're used to working on weekends, responding to emails at night and what have you. In France, at 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, forget it. Until the next, until Monday morning, 9 o'clock, they are off the radar.
Okay, so in January this year, the French government actually legislated against sending work-related emails to employees. So, in fact, you couldn't do that.
Yeah.
But, in our profession, we're actually essentially working 24-7 because
it is a news cycle.
Yeah, because of the news cycle and because perhaps it fits our personality as well. We don't mind the fact that we're constantly kind of consuming information
In a way, when you magnify that by millions and millions and millions of people, which is why now you've got the Asian Century, and that's why you've got productivity. Even in our worst years, 4% for Malaysia. It's something that the French and the Americans and the Italians and the Germans and the Brits would give their left legs for.
Well, the question is, is there a sweet spot between
Perennial policy, that is the conundrum, isn't it?
It is the conundrum. We'll be back with more after this. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Morning Run continues. Khoo Soo Chuang, Tan Chung Han and myself, Shaurya Kutan. That was Brick House by the Commodores. Slightly more mellow, a change from the guitar riffs that we've been listening to all morning, but...
Nothing wrong with guitar riffs in the morning.
Nothing wrong with what's going to happen right now, which is a rundown of the top business stories of the day that we're going to be covering. And Han, you've got the mic.
All right, so we got to look at what's happening in the oil space. Saudi Arabia and Russia both have signaled an oil cut extension into 2018. If you recall, the previous deadline was just next month, right? June. So they've got a meeting coming up in a couple of weeks, May 25th. And word is, they're already set to extend that production cut deal all the way into 2018.
Well, exactly what the oil industry needs, right? Because West Texas is at $45 a barrel and Brent is not much better than that. So it does need a bit of a fillip.
Right. And then the question is, even then, will this prolonged production cut be enough? Now, I think that's going to be a question mark in order to, if the end game is to, prop up oil prices.
Okay, talking about cuts, Arukanda.
Ouch.
Well,
that's pretty good. Yeah, that's pretty good.
Arul Kanda.
He has been removed from the TRX and Abanda Malaysia boards. Now, he says that his removal was expected, although he has yet to receive the official notification. So that's getting a lot of real estate in the papers today.
Students of journalism, take note, because you can write an entire story of about 400 words based on just 5 lines of text.
Exactly.
Which is exactly what the Edge did.
I know.
Based on the line, this was expected. Why was it expected? And will we find out more after this?
Yes, we will. And I think it's also important to note that when we look ahead to the discussion after the 7:30 bulletin, we're going to ask ourselves, because this time last year, Arukanda actually made this comment saying that his job was done. Now, a year later, we are finding out, well, that's not necessarily the case.
Okay, so also expected, a media prima buying RevAsia's digital assets.
All right, so this is the story we've been talking about for the last couple of days, right? So if this deal goes through, these companies claim this would create Malaysia's largest digital media company. Now, Chuang, you're in the publishing industry, right? I mean, what do you think of this? Do you think this will have enough clout or enough to really shake up the digital space here in Malaysia?
I'll be quite interested to see what the Malaysian Competition Commission has to say about this, because this is interesting. Malaysia's not a big market, and there's only two ways for a company to grow. Either you do it organically by yourself, or you do it inorganically by spending 105 million ringgit to buy a competitor.
And that's a good point, because that 105 million ringgit price tag there, that's, I think that will warrant some a closer look when we discuss this after 7:30, because if you look at Media Prima, they lost almost 60 million ringgit last year. And as of last year, I was looking at Bloomberg Terminal, Media Prima had cash and equivalents of about 300 million ringgit. So in other words, they're spending all this money, but the idea you would think is to try and make some profit back, but as you saw last year, that had really hasn't been the case. So it'd be interesting to see post-acquisition, how Media Prima can leverage on RevAsia and try to make some money.
Okay, so coming up, remember, global oil prices, Arukanda and Media Prima. Up next, we're going to have the news at 7 o'clock, but before that, we have No Rain by Blind Melon, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.